baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
Sun Ra. Hailed as one of the great big band leaders, pianists, and surrealists of jazz of the New York Times. Composer, keyboardist, band leader, philosopher, poet, and self-proclaimed extraterrestrial, Sun Ra arrived on the Earth 100 years ago on May 22, 1914. This Thursday, May 22, 2014, KBOO will dedicate the airwaves to 12 hours of the music, life, and philosophy of one of the 20th century's greatest avant-garde artists, Sun Ra. Beginning at 7 p.m., continuing all night long until 7 a.m. with a special in-studio performance of the Sonic Innovators Orchestra, featuring students of Thera Memories and conducted by David Ornette Cherry at 9 p.m. That's this Thursday, beginning at 7 p.m., a 12-hour tribute to the phenomena known as Sun Ra, here on KBOO Portland.
How do you stop it?
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid, and I want to invite you to a very special 8-hour Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience right here on KBOO 90.7 FM from 12 o'clock noon to 8 p.m. with JJ leading us off from 12 noon to 2 o'clock, followed by Sequoina Wright from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m., followed by yours truly, Shahid, from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m., and Reggae Bob taking us home from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m. From the old to the new, just for you, a very special Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience. Monday, May the 26th, 12 noon to 8 p.m., right here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM and online, www.kboo.fm radio.
KBOO, push it.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com. This KBOO program...
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Oregon counties pass initiatives to ban genetically modified crops.
Preliminary results are in for local and state primary elections. We'll review the highlights.
Workers rally in downtown Portland for a $15 minimum wage.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Preliminary results are in from yesterday's primary elections, and judging by the returns, Oregon voters are in a mood to maintain the political status quo. Voters in Portland said no to the establishment of a citizen-led water district. If passed, the measure would have taken oversight of Portland's water and sewer operations out of the hands of City Hall and placed it with a citizen-led utility district. The measure was struck down resoundingly, with more than 70% of voters rejecting the proposal. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber has secured the Democratic bid to run for an unprecedented fourth term in office. He'll face off this fall against State Representative Dennis Richardson, who took the Republican nomination by a landslide. In the closely watched race for U.S. Senate seats, Monica Webby beat out fellow Republican candidate Jason Conger by more than 10 points. That's despite recent allegations that Webby has been called out by the police for harassing both an ex-boyfriend and an ex-husband. Webby will look to unseat Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley in this fall's election. Portland City Council won't be changing its stripes much. City Commissioners Dan Saltzman and Nick Fish appear to have won their respective elections outright, with more than 60% of the vote each. This means neither will likely face a runoff in the November general election. Multnomah County Commissioner Deborah Cafori beat out former Portland City Commissioner Jim Francesconi by more than 50 points in her bid to fill former Chair Jeff Cogan's unfinished term, plus four additional years. A Conservative Action Committee-backed effort to oust two sitting commissioners in Clackamas County appears to have narrowly failed. Lake Oswego-based political action committee, the Oregon Transformation Project, poured money into the campaigns of two conservative commission candidates, Steve Bates, who is chairman of the Boring Community Planning Organization, and Lake Oswego City Councilor Karen Bowerman. High dollar support and contentious politicking wasn't enough to unseat incumbent commissioners Jim Bernard and Paul Savas, who each garnered just over 50% of the votes in their respective races, according to partial returns. If the numbers hold, neither commissioner will face a runoff in this fall's general election. The Clackamas County Elections Office says it still has several hundred votes left to count and that it plans to issue an update on the results tomorrow. The Oregon Transformation Project is best known for throwing its conservative weight behind statewide races, but this isn't the PAC's first play for power in local elections. In recent years, it has also backed the conservative agenda on various measures in Gladstone, Damascus, and Milwaukee, including funding for light rail and libraries. In other local election returns, Milwaukee will fund its $4 million light rail bill with general obligation bonds repaid through existing property taxes. The Beaverton School District successfully floated a bond to repair and modernize its schools, and yesterday was also a good day for Oregon's libraries. Voters in Oregon City said yes to a $6 million library expansion, and Canby will move forward with plans for a new library and civic center.
Jackson and Josephine counties in southern Oregon successfully passed ballot initiatives yesterday that will ban genetically modified crops. The measures faced a well-funded opposition campaign that was led by agricultural giant Monsanto. At the time of this broadcast, the Jackson County measure had passed by a large 66% majority. KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke this afternoon with Elise Higley of Our Family Farms Coalition and a campaign director for the initiative.
How do you feel about the initiative victory on Tuesday yesterday?
Well, obviously, we are absolutely thrilled. You know, this was a group of farmers coming together and trying to fight for their right back to grow and collect their seed and grow crops that wouldn't be contaminated by genetically engineered pollen. And the community really rose to the occasion to support us and, you know, let the valley know that they really value family farmers. And, you know, we won the biggest chemical companies in the world on this, and we are just really grateful to the community.
So do you expect court challenges?
We certainly hope not. I mean, we won by such a landslide. I hope the people's, you know, choice is really stands out. So
do you know of other similar initiative victories that have happened around the United States?
Right. Well, we just had our neighboring county, Josephine County, voted in their measure last night as well, too.
Let me get this straight. So Jackson County is the one that wasn't challenged by the statewide law.
Correct.
Okay. So you have a little more legal cushion, it seems like.
Right. It is important to hear what the people have to say as well. So we'll see how that goes.
But are these the first initiatives in the country or not?
No. There are definitely others, and we look at, you know, we looked a lot at the history of what's happening in other counties on the West Coast. Marin, Santa Cruz, as an example, in Washington, San Juan Islands. But we're looking at, you know, other counties and how the measure has served them. And, you know, county commissioners and administrators all agree, we're all positive about the economic benefits of the measure for their county, and that they've never had any violations in the measure. And so we're really feeling confident that that would be the same in Jackson County.
So now there's a statewide initiative for GMO labeling in Oregon. Looks like another step in the process.
Right, exactly. And, you know, as a family farmer, I'm obviously happy to see that coming up, and just feel that that's just yet another tool to give, you know, people, food eaters, a chance to know where their food is coming from. And, you know, family farmers are, you know, working hard to grow non-GMO food, and it's good to connect the consumers with an easy way for them to be able to find it. And in return, really does help family farmers. So we're in complete support of that.
So what do you grow on your farm?
Oh, gosh, we grow everything. We grow fruits and vegetables and herbs, and we have go to 4 farmers markets a week and local restaurants and local grocery stores and, restaurants.
So I take it the whole farmers market network has been a place where you've been able to really reach out to people on this initiative.
Definitely, definitely. All our farmers markets are GMO-free. Nobody has been growing GMO food in our valley. So that's really what, you know, customers are wanting, and food eaters are really looking to connect themselves with the farmer and the food they want to eat. So it's a good vehicle to do it.
And after all, we are all food eaters.
Exactly. So yeah, that's what we were saying in the campaign. You know, you're in the game. If you eat food, this measure matters to you.
Well, great. Well, once again, congratulations. Any last thoughts?
No. We're just really, grateful to the community. We've been joking last night that $1 million can't buy Jack. So Jackson County definitely showed them that the money couldn't buy them out. And we're really proud to be here right now.
And that $1 million came from Monsanto and other corporations?
Almost $1 million. Funded by the largest chemical companies in the world. So it feels really good to have the people's decision be so strong in favor of family farms.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking with us, Elise.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jackson County, home to Medford and Ashland, and Josephine County in Southern Oregon, now join 5 other counties in Oregon and Washington that have banned the cultivation of genetically modified crops. The long-term safety of genetically modified crops remains unknown, since no long-term studies have been performed, but critics say that we cannot afford to make a wrong decision that could impact our entire world food supply. KABU will continue coverage of this issue this Friday morning with Positively Revolting Talk Radio at 8 on Saturday's March on Monsanto in Portland, and at 11 with an hour-long special with host Paul Rowland on the initiative victories and the ongoing campaign against genetically modified crops and GMO labeling here in Oregon.
Around 100 workers and supporters gathered outside Portland City Hall at noon today to call for an increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. One of the speakers at the rally was Nicholas Caleb, who got 18% of the vote in his run against Commissioner Dan Saltzman in yesterday's election. Caleb ran on the platform of increasing the minimum wage in Oregon to $15 an hour, what he and other supporters of the measure call a living wage.
Start advocating for the general working class. People will start to join unions, and they'll look at unions and say, these guys are out there for me. They care about me. You destroy that whole image that's been built up over the last 50 years of what unions are. We all know that. We know what that's not what unions are like, right? We know that unions are about the general working class. Let's show everybody that they are for jumping in the fight for 15. So I just wanted to say a little bit about what's going on in Seattle, because they're kind of our sister city in the struggle. They really led us into the struggle. And Shama Sawant is a hero in my eyes already. What happened is Shama got elected on a $15 an hour minimum wage campaign. And she was so successful in organizing in Seattle that every single city council member had to say that they support 15. They had to publicly come out and say $15 an hour minimum wage. Everybody, corporate Democrats, all the rest. They won that battle. As soon as she got into office, they put a committee together, went behind closed doors, brought in Starbucks and Boeing and all these corporate guys in, negotiated down what we're calling the fake 15. They negotiated down, they put a bunch of exemptions in it, they put a bunch of exceptions in it, they have tip credits, they've got health care credits, they're phasing it in over 7 years for certain groups, 5 years for the giant corporations. Do they need 5 years to pay a minimum wage of greater than what's on? Right, it's total crap. They don't need it, they could do it right now. So what's happening up in Seattle right now is that there's a ballot initiative movement that's going to go alongside this. And what they're going to do is it'll be 15 now for all the big businesses. They can afford to pay 15, and then a 3-year phase in for small businesses. What we need to do right now is let them know nationwide how much of an example they are for the rest of us. We need to put pressure on them and support them financially if possible, with people going there, so that they can collect those signatures. If they get 15, a real 15 in Seattle, it's going to be a huge, huge, huge kick in the ass of the rest of the movement around the country. So all I want to say is thank you so much for showing up today, guys. You bring attention to an issue that we need brought attention to in the city. I love you guys. Mayuna, go.
The workers chanted, "What do we want? 15," in reference to the $15 an hour minimum wage that they are proposing the city of Portland adopt. The protesters took a petition to the office of Mayor Charlie Hales, whose representative made no specific promises, but said that Mayor Hales would bring up the idea of an increase in the minimum wage nationwide to the upcoming National Conference of Mayors. KABU also spoke with Anne, who works at the Portland Zoo and participated in the rally.
There's been a lot of changes in management over the last few years. With the pay freeze, that's like saying experience doesn't matter. Somebody who's hired yesterday is getting paid the same as somebody who's been working there for 3 years. It doesn't make any sense. It makes it hard to keep good people. It leads to bad customer service. We want to make the zoo better for workers, for keepers, for the Portland public, for our visitors that come in every year.
And what role do you think the 15 Now campaign will play in that?
That's enormous. Food workers really got united last year in the organizing drive, and we've been building our relationship with other members, the keepers and horticulture and all these other guys that are so integral to zoo operations. With 15, that would mean that workers, we wouldn't all have to have two jobs. We wouldn't have to go on unemployment every spring when people get laid off. We wouldn't have to be on food stamps anymore.
You get laid off every spring?
With the temporary status, which most of us are in, there's a 1,040 hours cap. By the end of zoo lights, people have burned through their hours. So come spring, hours roll over again July 1st. So come spring and beginning of summer, all of our most experienced people are laid off or they're looking for other jobs. And there's new trainees come in, new temporary workers. So there's fewer and fewer remaining staff to train more and more new people. Training at the zoo right now is a joke. And new management is trying to improve that situation. But when it comes down to it, the people that have been there for years, we know how it goes. Experience matters there. Knowing good customer service skills, knowing how to use the cash register, knowing how to use, there's three different restaurants plus all the little food carts. There's a lot to know around there. There's this misconception that service industry work is unskilled work. I'll invite anybody to come out and test that presumption because it's not true at all.
In your negotiations, are you working on trying to get rid of that hours cap in order to prevent the necessity to go on unemployment each spring?
Well, in Metro's own policy, they describe temporary work as emergency, non-reoccurring work. We don't think that the summer season is emergency, and it's definitely reoccurring. We would like to see some permanent positions created. In the bargaining process, it gets a little tricky. We can't force them to make permanent positions. What we're trying to do is abide by their own policy and recognize that somebody who's been there for years is not a temporary employee, and they're not a replaceable, expendable employee. We are college-educated workforce. We are families, single parents, couples, parents and their kids, brothers and sisters. These are people at the zoo sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was the question?
Well, no, it was just about the unemployment each spring, but I wanted to see if you have an answer for people like Lars Larson, who says that if we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, then there won't be opportunity for advancement because the employer won't be able to pay employees more if they've been there longer, because they'll all get 15.
Well, there's already no opportunity for advancement. I'm a line lead. I'm responsible for training new people. I have a second job now, and my manager at the zoo is asking me to come back on Sundays and my day off to train new cashiers. I've been making $11.28 for the last 4 years. There is no opportunity for advancement at all. And you know what? As far as the argument that the price of goods will go up, when I started there 7 years ago, the price of an elephant ear was around $3.25. It's now $5 for an elephant ear. That money isn't going to the workers. I don't know where it's going. It's not going to us, the people actually making and selling those things.
Great. Well, thank you. And you want to introduce yourself for KBOO?
Yeah, I'm Ann McDonald. I'm a food service worker at the Oregon Zoo, and I'm a proud Liuna member.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the items passed at this morning's city council meeting was a right-of-way for expanding a Verizon cell network. It came on the heels of a plan to explore a high-bandwidth fiber-optic internet service in the city of Portland that would be constructed by Google. Ben Barber spoke at this morning's hearing.
I actually can't answer lots of your engineering questions regarding this, but I don't think those are as pertinent as necessarily other issues along the lines of net neutrality and also maybe common carrier status and efficiency of these small cell sites. I would propose, for instance, that Sprint be the one to trial this because they have won the most spectrum and thus can actually produce more cost-efficient base stations per bandwidth delivered because you can only get a maximum of two bits per hertz. And furthermore, they have not opposed net neutrality on the same level that Verizon or, say, AT&T have. Sprint may very well need to have a network backhaul, but as I'm sure you're aware, you're working on an intergovernmental agreement with Google, and I'm sure Google might be happy to provide some of that network backhaul for Sprint, but I strongly advise against, in particular, using AT&T and Verizon unless their stance on net neutrality changes. Do you have any engineering questions? Oh, I've also worked for Verizon Wireless, if that makes any difference.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Questions? Thanks very much. Any further questions for staff? Appreciate your good work. We depend a lot on the amazing staff, as Commissioner Fritz said, at our Office of Community Technology. So,
Mayor and Commissioners, Mary Beth Henry again. I did just want to clarify that today's item is the Verizon ordinance authorizing the small cell program. Next Wednesday, the AT&T ordinance will be before you, but it's the same framework.
Right.
So I just wanted to make sure that you understood that.
Verizon. The measure passed with no dissenting votes.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales and Commissioner Steve Novick are set to unveil plans tomorrow for a brand new citywide street maintenance fee. The city has been floating two possible configurations for the maintenance fee, which would raise more than $50 million a year to maintain and improve city streets. The focus would be on upgrading dangerous intersections. One would charge $8 a month to every Portland household. The other option would charge around $12 to Portland households. An unspecified separate fee would be charged to businesses. Nothing is on the books yet, but the Portland Mercury published documents today indicating that the city will likely opt for the $12 option, with lower-income households paying a reduced rate of $8. The city also plans to post a fee calculator online to help businesses gauge their own potential fees. Novick and Hales say that the fee wouldn't kick in till summer 2015. The Portland City Council is expected to discuss the possible maintenance fee at its regular meeting next week. So far, there has been no mention of putting the fee to a vote.
Ranchers in eastern Oregon have agreed to increase protections for a potentially endangered bird in Harney County. The agreement will allow landowners to voluntarily manage their lands to reduce the threats to the greater sage grouse. It was negotiated between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Harney Soil and Water Conservation District. In return for voluntary protection, sage grouse on their own land, the ranchers will receive assurances against additional regulations if the sage grouse is ever listed under the Endangered Species Act. Greater sage grouse are found in 11 states and two Canadian provinces. They're listed as an endangered species candidate. A listing decision could occur in September of 2015. The agreement covers more than 1 million acres of private rangelands within the range of greater sage grouse in Harney County.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Peter Zuckerman of Oregon United for Marriage about this week's historic ruling allowing same-sex couples to marry in Oregon, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with intervals of clouds and sunshine, warm with a high of 82. Our friends at radcast.org have stopped producing daily radiation counts due to a lack of volunteer support. If you are interested in helping with this citizen-led radiation count, contact the organizers at radcast.org. Today in history, on May 21, 1927, Charles Lindbergh landed in Paris, completing the first non-stop transatlantic flight. Lindbergh was an unknown when he entered a competition for a $25,000 prize to anyone available and able to fly non-stop from New York to Paris. The quote of the day is from Leonardo da Vinci, who said, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication."
It's 5:26. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Hypothetical conundrums can provide valuable learning experiences for students of corporate management and ethics. So let's study one. Suppose you're a corporate chieftain who's a free enterprise fundamentalist, despising government regulation, taxation, and intervention in the purity of the holy marketplace. But whoopsie-daisy, suddenly a new competitor to your O-line product pops up, and more of your customers are switching to the alternative. Conundrum! You're being outcompeted, so do you try to compete better or what? If you're the reigning princess of anti-government extremism, you go straight to what? This is not a hypothetical conundrum, but a real one, faced by the Koch brothers, the fossil fuel duo who feel threatened by the steady increase in the number of middle-class families who are putting solar panels on their roofs. Not only is this free, non-polluting sun energy slashing families' utility bills, but they can also make money from it. Today's efficient solar cells produce more electricity than a home needs. And 43 states allow these rooftop energy producers to sell their excess production back to the grid. It's free enterprise at its most free and enterprising. So, naturally, the Kochs and the utility monopolies hate it. Thus, these old power behemoths are tossing their libertarian purity overboard and sending their lobbyists across country to demand that state governments intervene in the marketplace to stop these pesky rooftop competitors from competing in the marketplace. And, adding to their hypocrisy, they want states to tax homeowners as punishment for becoming innovative energy producers. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's not the American way, but it is the corporate way. As Lily Tomlin tells us, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Rather than face the protests and hear the voices of its workers, McDonald's Corporation Wednesday closed and cleared its corporate headquarters in Illinois. The workers brought their fight for $15 an hour and a union to the corporate headquarters, where McDonald's is holding its annual shareholders meeting. About 100 workers sat down, risking arrest and a civil disobedience action. Emmanuel Gonzalez was one of the workers risking arrest.
I'm sitting here in front of the McDonald's Corporation, where we are doing a civil protest for the fight for 15. There is no one arrested in this yet, but we have already been told that it's possible for others to be arrested. I'm in front of the McDonald's Corporation with thousands of people. We are protesting against McDonald's because they do not pay us a fair wage of $15 an hour, which is what we are requesting. And we have already been told that we are possibly going to be arrested.
Fight for 15 spokesperson Nazli DiMaggio says that McDonald's shutting down its corporate headquarters to avoid the worker protesters is a testament to the power of the fast food worker movement.
I think it just shows how much power this movement has. You know, and instead of McDonald's playing games and shutting down headquarters, they should just listen to the demands of these workers and pay them a living wage so that they're not struggling in poverty.
But the very time when more people are using public transit systems are struggling for money. It is an absolute no-brainer for Congress to refund the highway bill, which of course includes money for transit programs. It's a no-brainer. There's not going to be safe, affordable public transportation in the United States of America without the refunding of the bill.
Transport Workers Union Local 100 President John Samuelson, TWU, is urging substantial investment in public transit.
There's any message that we want to get across, it's that, you know, send money, pump money, invest money into public transit. It's good for American citizens, it's good for American workers, and it's good for the American economy.
Michigan's building and construction trade unions are contributing at least $3 to $5 million to a fund to help cover retiree benefits in the Detroit bankruptcy grand bargain. Republican Michigan House Speaker Jace Bulger demanded that unions fork over cash before the legislature approves the deal. The legislature must approve $195 million of an overall $816 million package for Detroit to help the city emerge from bankruptcy. The money is an effort to mitigate pension cuts for 32,000 Detroit public workers while preventing the sell-off of Detroit's art museum collection. Some foundations in the Detroit Institute of the Arts are pledging the bulk of the $816 million over 20 years. The National Labor Relations Board says that the American Postal Workers Union has a right to seek details on a pilot program of privatization that the Postal Service is conducting in the Midwest. The Postal Service had resisted sharing that information with the union, claiming those programs are exempt from the union contract requiring disclosure. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The British oil giant BP said today that it plans to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to avoid having to compensate the victims of its 2010 oil spill. BP's lawyers argue that some of the claims that they have been required to pay have involved losses that were unrelated to the oil spill. But residents of the Gulf Coast successfully argued that their financial and personal losses were directly related to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the largest spill in U.S. history. BP filed a lawsuit in order to avoid paying and lost the case. The company has appealed twice and has lost both appeals. But the oil giant says it's ready to take the case to the Supreme Court. BP lawyers claim that the ruling against it allows an overly broad definition of who can join in a class of victims covered in a damage settlement. If the Supreme Court accepts the case and rules in BP's favor, it could affect future class action lawsuits and end up doing exactly what BP is claiming, delaying compensation for victims of accidents like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
And now for the latest news from an indigenous perspective, we turn to our friends at nativenews.net.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Transfer of management of the South Unit of Badlands National Park to the Oglala Sioux Tribe has been a years-long process. Recently, public meetings on bison management were canceled, which raised concerns among some Native people and the South Dakota Stock Growers Association. As Jim Kent reports, questions surround what the intentions of the National Park Service and the tribe will be toward landowners and those who lease land near the South Unit.
A plan for general management of the South Unit was enacted in 2006. Badlands National Park Superintendent Eric Brennerman says that plan resulted in a goal to turn the South Unit into a tribal national park managed by the Oglala Sioux Tribe.
That all sounds great, but we don't know what a tribal national park is. It's never been defined before.
That initial definition, says Brennerman, has been forwarded to Washington, D.C. for review prior to the ultimate requirement for any new national park, congressional approval. Despite the length of time involved in that approval process, the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council passed an ordinance to begin laying the groundwork for reintroducing bison to its yet undesignated tribal national park. The tribe's plan to reintroduce bison includes acquiring land adjacent to the South Unit that's either currently owned by tribal members or leased to tribal ranchers for grazing their livestock. Oglala Sioux Tribal spokesperson Chuck Jacobs says the situation is really a non-issue, fueled by a few outspoken members of the Pine Ridge Reservation community. Meanwhile, Badlands National Park Superintendent Eric Brunerman insists that the National Park Service has no plans to condemn anyone's property, neither will it allow for the expansion of the South Unit. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Alaska Native people living along the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska observe the ice in the river breaking up seemingly in reverse this year. Some elders say it's a sign of climate change. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
The Kuskokwim has been a travel route for the Yupik people since ancient times and still dictates seasonal activities. Just about 20 miles from Bethel, Atmotok Elder Henry Tikian says he's never seen this happen as he recounts growing up 50 miles inland from the mouth of the river in Bethel.
In my first memories in Bethel, upriver areas like McGrath and Aniak would always break up first. After that, downriver would break up, even though it's closer to the ocean.
Tikin says ice would be much thicker in those days. Breakup would be signaled by loud rumbling from the river caused by ice grinding and breaking against each other, often waking him up at night. He says the climate is changing because of the way people treat the land. Tikin points to trashed field drums along riverbanks as just one of numerous examples. At the mouth of the Kuskokwim from the village of Tuntutuliak, elder and pilot James Charles says early downriver breakup is attributed to the lack of snow and thin ice.
The lower area had no snow and the ice was thin, so it broke up first. It usually breaks up last when there's snow.
On the south side of the Kuskokwim Bay, elder John Alexi says breakup near the village of Eek was similar to just one that occurred about a decade ago. He says warming temperatures were predicted by his ancestral elders.
I used to hear from people who came before me that the weather would change and the winters would be different. It wouldn't be as cold as it used to be.
While breakup was unusual this year, Yupik elders say similar breakups may not be uncommon in the future. In Bethel, I am Charles Enoch.
In May 2012, the Oregon Board of Education voted to ban Indian mascots in schools. The issue then went to the state legislature. The governor signed a bill this year giving schools the opportunity to keep their Indian mascots. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
In the latest Native news from U.S. occupied Afghanistan, the Pakistani airstrike today killed 60 people near the Afghan border. The Pakistani military claims all 60 were rebel fighters. The airstrikes mainly targeted Mir Ali, a town in the lawless tribal region of North Waziristan.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. Israeli troops invade areas in Gaza and injure one civilian, and in the West Bank destroy farmer homes in the Jordan Valley. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army shot and injured a young Palestinian man in the head on Wednesday morning in the neighborhood of Al-Farahin to the east of Khan Yunis city in southern Gaza Strip. The victim has been identified as Salah Al-Far'a, age 20, according to media sources. Al-Far'a sustained moderate wounds in the head and was taken to a clinic in the city, medical sources reported. Meanwhile, Israeli military vehicles fired smoke bombs at Palestinian farmlands, burning the wheat crops belonging to Palestinian farmers. Civil defense crews rushed to the area, managing to extinguish the fire, preventing the burning of nearby crops. Staying in the Gaza Strip, Israeli Navy vessels attacked Palestinian fishing boats in Gaza waters close to the shore of Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip and kidnapped two fishermen. Eyewitnesses have reported that the Navy fired rounds of live ammunition at boats while fishing within the 6 allocated nautical miles and took the two men to unknown destination. The Israeli Navy frequently attacks Palestinian fishing boats in the Gaza waters and even while docked at the Gaza shore. The attacks led to property damage in addition to dozens of casualties and arrests. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers demolished 20 barracks in Jiftlik village in the Jordan Valley on Wednesday morning. As a result of the military action, 25 Palestinian families have been left homeless. In the aftermath of the Six-Day War in the 1967, over 800 homes in Al-Jiftlik were razed by the Israeli army and its 6,000 inhabitants were ordered to leave. Since then, most of Al-Jiftlik's inhabitants returned to the village. Following the 1993 Oslo Accords between Israel and the PLO, the village was designated as part of Area C, putting it under full Israeli military and civil administration. Earlier on Wednesday, three Palestinians were kidnapped by Israeli forces from the Jenin district in northern West Bank, in addition to two others from Jerusalem area, according to reports by local and security sources. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, May 21st, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
A Palestinian farmer was seriously injured this morning by Israeli military forces in East Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. This morning, 20-year-old Saleh El-Fara was farming in an agricultural area on the border between the Gaza Strip and Israel in the East Khan Yunis. He was shot in the head and is now at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis receiving medical care. This is not the first time that attacks like this have happened in the Gaza Strip. Since the year 2000, the Gazan's agricultural lands in the borderline between the Strip and Israel have been attacked many times, and dozens of farmers have been killed by Israeli forces.
The family of a Washington woman killed in Gaza in 2003 had their last day in an Israeli court today, 9 years after filing their civil lawsuit against the State of Israel. Rachel Corey was 23 years old, a native of Olympia, Washington, when she was crushed to death March 16, 2003, by an Israeli military bulldozer while nonviolently protesting demolition of Palestinian civilian homes in Rafah, Gaza. The following day, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon promised President George W. Bush a, quote, thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing. In 2004, Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff informed the Corey family of the U.S. government's position that the Israeli investigation did not meet these standards and advised them to use the Israeli court system. The Corys filed suit in 2005, charging the State of Israel and its Ministry of Defense with responsibility for Rachel's killing. Today's appeal to Israel's High Court is the final possible appeal of the initial ruling, which had concluded that the Israeli military was not responsible for Rachel's death. Rachel Corey's father, Craig, said that during the past 9 years, the family has sought accountability in the Israeli courts for Rachel's killing, but were instead handed a verdict that showed indifference to the rights of the victim. The Corey family appeal focuses on serious flaws in the lower court verdict, which ignored and misinterpreted essential facts about the case. Tune in tomorrow evening at 5:45 to KBOO News in Depth for an exclusive interview with the parents of Rachel Corey about their lawsuit.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mohammed Nabil, Paul Rowland, and Aaron J. Bernard. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty interviews Cameron Doss, District Director of the U.S. Small Business Administration, in honor of National Small Business Week. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olson Osterlund speaks with Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, about the closed Guantanamo Global Day of Action, May 23rd. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll go straight to Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Sarika Mehta hosts Between the Covers. Her guest is Julia Cook, author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. And at 11:30, S.W. Conser and Jen Chavez host The Film Show with news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support in our recent spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still join or renew by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview conducted by KABU's Janka Soderberg on this week's historic ruling on marriage equality and some of the history of the struggle here in Oregon.
Are joined on the line now by Peter Zuckerman with Oregon United for Marriage, which is celebrating a ruling earlier this week that was made by a judge here in Oregon. Can you explain from our listeners exactly what the ruling was and what it means for same-sex couples here in Oregon?
This was a huge victory. The judge struck down a law that exclude same-sex couples from marriage in Oregon. And as a result, all loving and committed couples in Oregon, including gay and lesbian couples, now have the freedom to marry the person they love.
So what was the basis of the ruling?
The ruling was that the measure, Measure 36 is what it's called, is unconstitutional, and it's unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
And that Measure 36, is that the amendment to the Constitution that was passed by Oregon voters 10 years ago?
Yes, it was passed in 2004, and it excludes gay and lesbian couples from marriage.
And how is it that that was passed in Oregon back in 2004? Were you a part of that as well, and you know some of that history?
I was in school at the time, but I was a volunteer. So, yes. And since then, you know, our state and our country have been on a journey of understanding. More and more people have talked to their friends and family and neighbors about why marriage matters to gay and lesbian couples for the same reason that it matters to everyone else. I mean, for me, it's as simple as treating others as one would hope to be treated, includes allowing everyone to have the freedom to marry. And more Oregonians have come to see it that way.
Now, this isn't the first time, at least here in Multnomah County, that people who are same gender have been able to get married. Previously, I think it was back in 2004, there was a brief time when the Multnomah County clerk started issuing marriage licenses that I think later had to be annulled.
That's correct. There were marriage licenses were briefly issued in 2004. But then those marriages were made invalid, and the couples were actually reimbursed for their marriage licenses. But and those marriages do not count today, but every loving and committed couple now has the freedom to marry in Oregon.
So do you know if any of the couples who originally got married 10 years ago have now remarried under the new ruling?
I believe that has happened, yes.
And in 2004, the constitutional amendment was passed as a ballot initiative. Does this court ruling officially overturn it? Is there a chance another ballot initiative, say, could put it back into the Oregon Constitution?
This ruling supersedes what we had, what we passed before. The judge declared that excluding same-sex couples from marriage in Oregon is unconstitutional and against the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. So I don't know the legal technicalities, and legal cases are full of twists and turns, but we are feeling very confident with that this ruling is going to stay.
Well, and this is just the latest in a series of states that have had similar court decisions following a federal ruling that that same-sex couples can marry under the Equal Protection Clause. Is it going to the national level at some point, do you think?
I think it's already at a national level. Ever since the Supreme Court last year ruled on the Windsor case, striking down key parts of the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, it opened up a legal pathway to win the freedom to marry in Oregon and in other states. And we now have 18 states that have won the freedom to marry. And in more than a dozen cases where a judge has evaluated cases about marriage equality, every single judge has ruled on the right side of history.
Well, and it's interesting, in Pennsylvania yesterday, the judge who ruled on the case compared it to Brown versus the Board of Education, which ended school segregation, and made a similar historical argument that what we're seeing now is a change that will be historical. And I wonder if you see that comparison to the civil rights movement and the segregation that went on up until the 1960s.
You know, I think that discrimination plays out really differently among different communities and different identities, but that discrimination is wrong no matter the form. And we've seen a huge outpouring of support from people of all backgrounds, from communities of color, from businesses, from Democrats to Republicans, and that's what it takes to win this kind of thing.
Well, people around the Portland area have probably seen the petitions that have been circulating for a ballot initiative this November that would allow for same-sex marriage. Is that ballot initiative now going to be pulled now that this court ruling has been made?
In April, Oregon United for Marriage noted in an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, that if the judge ruled in a way that allowed same-sex couples to marry before May 23rd, we would not need to move forward with the signatures. With loving couples marrying across the state, the campaign committee, the executive committee, is going to make a final decision regarding the signatures after consulting with coalition partners and leaders involved with the campaign. But we're feeling very confident that we will not need the ballot measure.
You know how many people have been married since Monday's ruling?
I know that more than 100 people have been married since the ruling, that people are marrying all across the state. And, some people have been waiting decades for this moment. This is the historic moment we've been waiting for.
Wow. And what are some of the responses or the stories that you've heard from people who have been able to marry this week that have been waiting a long time?
I just got an update. We have had 215 licenses issued across the state in the last 2 days. And, I mean, I've heard amazing stories. I mean, I've seen people crying. I've been crying. You know, couples who have been together for such a long time and working for this moment for decades. And, you know, we got here, you know, thanks to the work of people who have been working on this issue for, you know, years and years. I mean, long before I got involved. It has been a big movement. It's been a long time coming, but we've won. And that is just so exciting. This is, you know, one thing we've been working for, although there's still a lot more we need to do.
Now, the one organization that filed a brief in opposition to the marriage equality was the National Organization for Marriage. That group has until August, I understand, to try to reinstate themselves as a party in this case. What do you think is the future of that? Do you think that there is a legal appeal that they will be able to file?
First of all, our opposition is an outside group from Washington, D.C. that flew in here to try to intervene in the case. And the judge has made it very clear that this was an Oregon case and is going to remain an Oregon case. There we're a free country, and there are some long-shot legal things that I'm sure they will try. We're feeling very confident in the decision that the judge has made.
Do you think that in Oregon or another state, marriage equality opponents will end up bringing a case to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that will happen eventually, yes.
Any idea what the potential ruling will be at that level?
You know, I'm really hopeful that that the U.S. Supreme Court will someday rule on the right side of history. I'm very hopeful that will happen.
So right now, Oregon United for Marriage is in celebration mode. What is next? Do you feel that this is over, or are there going to be future battles that the group will have to come together to fight?
You know, there is always more work to do from, transgender Oregonians still have trouble getting access to basic health care. Gay and trans people of color face the compounding disparities of homophobia and racism. Bullying is still a major issue. There are plenty of areas that still need a lot of work. And, you know, we've won this victory, but I think it's important to keep in mind that our community needs to look out for our community, and we're going to continue to do that.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've been speaking with Peter Zuckerman. He's with Oregon United for Marriage, which is a coalition of groups that came together to support marriage equality here in Oregon. Their website, OregonUnitedForMarriage.org. And thank you again, Peter, for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News In Depth.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Portland, 91.9 FM, Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, Occupy Radio.